Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I am reading all the comments people are writing on my channels and will respond to some of them in future videos. Please look at the description below the video. It contains links to my website where you can subscribe and donate. When I did an interview with Alex Linder on a Team White show the other day, he wanted to know about life in South Africa, and then while he was questioning me about this, he was asking me, why do blacks dance and sing in large crowds? Why is it that the blacks always appear to be dancing and singing? What's the story behind it? So I explained to him as best I could understand what this was and perhaps how it came about, because from my personal experiences in going to places where blacks have been violent, I've seen that their methods are actually designed to stop vehicles. Because in the days of apartheid, when the Jews and the commies were working overtime to get the blacks to fight the whites, the problem was that they wanted to try and make the townships ungovernable. Because South Africa is different to Rhodesia. In Rhodesia, most of the blacks lived in huts in the bush. South Africa is the most industrialized country in Africa. The parallels between South Africa and America are very close. There are a lot of close parallels. The only thing is that the white population is so small in comparison to the white population in America. But in other respects, the actual structure of the country and the way it functions, because the whites built up this country to such an extent, is very similar. So they couldn't use Vietnam-type techniques in South Africa. They couldn't fight in the bush because there isn't much bush to fight in. The places in the country that were mostly under white control, that were under the strongest white control, are here on the Transvaal and in the Free State and in the Cape. And it isn't that easy to wage a bush war here, especially not here in the Transvaal. I should mention that in the days of the war in Rhodesia, that among the terrorists, the black freedom fighters, as the Jews like to call them, because if a white guy is a freedom fighter, then he's the most evil person who ever existed. And somebody was telling me that the other day, I think on Newsweek or something, they had a whole big piece about Adolf Hitler and called it the evolution of evil. So when a white man is busy struggling for white freedom, then he's the devil. When a black man is busy struggling for his freedom, then he's a freedom fighter. If a white man commits no atrocities like Adolf Hitler did, then they'll invent atrocities and claim that he carried out those atrocities. If a black man carries out atrocities, then no, he's not really carrying out atrocities, and he has every right to do so. So that's how the world's Jew media has twisted everything, so that white people hate other white people, and all those other white people were trying to do was to be free and to continue with their lives. But for the blacks, there's no end to the number of excuses they'll come up with to excuse any black action. And Nelson Mandela himself said that in order to destroy apartheid, anything is moral. Any action is moral. So even if you start cutting people's limbs and ears and noses off, it's quite moral. In fact, Nelson Mandela himself advocated in writing that blacks who carry out acts of treason, for them, any black who cooperated with the white was treasonous. And we whites should be applying those same rules, actually, to our liberals, in which case we'd be hanging a whole lot of them. Nelson Mandela said that he wanted to come up with a means of punishing these blacks in a way that would really put them off. And his original idea was to cut their noses off. That was what Nelson Mandela wanted to do. He thought if he could cut their noses off, that would be better. But later they refined it and invented the thing known as necklacing. In the days of the war in Rhodesia, and I assume the same is true of the Portuguese in Angola and Mozambique, in the days of the Rhodesian War, the Rhodesian army often came across blacks who were coming to fight the Rhodesians, but they would be accompanied by blacks coming to fight in South Africa. So the Rhodesian army would kill them all. And it was common for the Rhodesian army to run into these ANC people in other places. And I suspect that the Portuguese also ran into ANC and PAC and those types who were coming to fight in South Africa. The ANC may have been the ones who came to power, but there was also the PAC, the Pan-African Congress or Pan-Africanist Congress. They were more radical than the ANC, but they never had quite the following of the ANC. However, they are responsible for the thing that you know as the Sharpeville Massacre. That was actually the PAC. And what the PAC did was they brought a huge crowd of blacks to attack a small police station. And these police were defending themselves, and that's when they shot about 60 or 70 blacks. And that has come to be known as, the Sharpeville Massacre, the day when the Boers went crazy. No, those few policemen in that little police station would have been annihilated. They had to defend themselves. And all the weapons the blacks brought with them to attack the whites, there are pictures of them. As we move on and I get time, I'll start putting up some pictures. But the problem for the ANC and the PAC in South Africa was to try and get a viable form of warfare going, a form of warfare that could actually stop the Boers. But in reality, their attempts at creating a warlike situation was always a failure because the Boers were much too prepared for them. The Boers were far too well armed, far too well organized. In fact, the Boers were so organized that the Boers weren't even really worried about fighting terrorist warfare. The Boers were actually preparing to fight a full-scale war against Russian tanks. That's actually what they were preparing for. The Boers were preparing for all-out combat in South Africa, and they had all the means for it. And when they built the highways, for example, they made sure that highways were straight so that military aircraft could land on them and stuff like that, so that any part of South Africa the military aircraft could go to, and if they needed to do emergency stuff, they could just land and take off on highways. So there were lots of preparations that the Boers did because the Boers were preparing for a conventional war. And later on, in 1976, the Cubans snuck into Africa in a communist army. That basically, the Warsaw Pact, the Russians and the Eastern Europeans created an army, and their third-party forces who were going to do the fighting were the Cubans, the Cuban commies under Castro, whom Nelson Mandela loves so much, and whom the Jews of America have been protecting so long. That's why you'll see that America never does anything against Cuba, even though it's this rotten communist state right next to America. I suspect, too, that JFK lost against the Russians in Cuba, that whole Cuban Missile Crisis thing. Even though they like to market it as a victory, it's actually not really a victory. Because if it was a victory, America would have taken over and driven communism out of Cuba. And in the 1980s, there was a conventional war in Angola between the Boers, the Cubans, there were Russian officers. It was commanded by Russian generals, and there were fighter pilots from Europe. I think there were some even from East Germany, possibly. But there were fighter pilots from communist countries, let's call it Western communist countries, who did come and fight in Angola. And the Boers had to fight them in the air and on the ground and so forth. The Boers didn't do badly. They shot down quite a lot of enemy jet aircraft. So they did pretty well, actually. But they fought a huge army that was armed with the latest weaponry in Angola. The CIA very possibly paid the Boers to be their third party, and they fought very hard over there. But even so, even though the Boers weren't really focusing on terrorism, they were taking care of the terrorists pretty adequately. The organization of the army under apartheid was very different to the organization of the Rhodesian army. And I did tell Alex off the air that Rhodesians who came to South Africa to join their army didn't do so well here. The Rhodesian army operated very differently to the South African army. The Rhodesian army wasn't really concerned with drilling and parade ground stuff and all that sort of thing. They were more concerned about getting into battle and actually fighting. So they didn't care too much about saluting and all that kind of stuff. They were more interested in your actual ability on the battlefield. But in South Africa, there was a much bigger structure. South Africa had much bigger structures. So whereas the entire Rhodesian Air Force, from the mechanics to the pilots, was maybe 1,000 strong, the South African Air Force was much bigger. Maybe some of the South Africans on the channel can give an exact number, but my suspicion is that it is well in excess of 20,000 people in the South African Air Force at the time. It may have been 50,000, maybe even more. The South African Navy, which was the smallest of all the services, was 10,000 strong. But the South African Army, whereas the Rhodesian Army, the actual whites in combat, were 28,000, the South African Army had a huge pool of manpower that actually stretched into the hundreds of thousands. The South African army at its peak could probably have called up 500,000 white men. It could probably have called up 500,000 white men. So it was big. It was unquestionably the most powerful military force in Africa. And potentially, even right now, with whites down to 4 million, potentially, the whites, if they organize themselves properly and they ever get some spirit and determination together, the whites potentially are actually still a very, very potentially strong military force. To the point where, if we maybe did our thing properly, we might be able to be the strongest in South Africa. We might be able to take on all the blacks. That is something that I personally believe is possible. I really believe it's possible. I really don't believe that whites are as buggered as you think they are. Despite being 9%, I really don't think we're as buggered as we think. Even when I was a teenager in Rhodesia and I was reading up on military history and thinking about things, and in my early 20s, I sat and did a lot of calculation and a lot of thinking. And back then, even, I just reckoned that whites definitely have got more potential than it appears due to their numbers alone. Just because we're 9% doesn't mean we have the power of 9%. We have much more power, much more. At the very least, we would have the power of three times that percentage. To say that we have the power of 30% of the blacks of South Africa. Easy. Easy peasy pie, really. But the bottom line is that the communists and the Jews and the liberals, as they were all trying to get the blacks to fight the Boers, because you must understand, the Jews are the ultimate cowards on the face of the earth. I want to repeat this, and there are some people who've gone against me for saying this, but I'm going to say this again as forcefully as I can. A Jew is the biggest coward on the face of the earth. Okay, I'm going to repeat that. A Jew is the biggest coward on the face of the earth, bar nobody. Okay, a Jew is the greatest coward on the planet. Even blacks have got, and blacks by themselves are cowards, okay? Even a black is several times braver than a Jew. A Jew is the ultimate coward on the face of the earth. And every single action of Jews is based around the fact that they are the ultimate cowards that exist. So when you hear, oh, the Jews won this battle because they were so brave. Bullshit, okay? Jews are the biggest cowards on the face of the earth. Their entire system, their entire setup, the way they think, the way they do things, absolutely makes it totally clear that Jews are the biggest cowards that have ever lived on the planet. And this is a very important psychological principle that everybody needs to understand. Every single thing about a Jew indicates he's the ultimate coward. They are so scared. And Jews don't believe in God and they don't believe in life after death. These are a very, very materialistic people. Alex Linda says, behind a crowd of angry blacks, you'll find a Jew with a megaphone. Even there, Alex Linda is giving Jews too much credit. Maybe in America, some of them will be behind them with a megaphone. In South Africa, the Jews were sitting in the upper class suburbs and they were scheming how to get the blacks to fight the whites. They were nowhere near the violence. Nowhere near the violence. They were sitting very safely far away from any violence that they were stoking. And the Jews have even on their own website, on the Jewish Board of Deputies website, they've even said that under apartheid, they had to deal with the Boers because the Boers protected them. The Jews will tell you the Boers protected them. So while the Boers were protecting the Jews and other whites, the Boers believing that the Jews are white, the Jews were working day and night to destroy the society and to bring about violence and unrest, just like they're doing in America right now, just like they've been doing for the last couple of years, just like they've been excelling at during the time with Donald Trump doing his stuff. You'll see all these leftists and so-called liberals, and you'll see all their attempts at lame violence. Now, you've noticed that even women, even fat girls, are getting all worked up and trying to become rebellious in America. That's because the Jews, and that includes the Jewish males, are far too cowardly to do the job themselves. So a fat white girl, okay, has got more guts than a Jew. And a dumb black has got about 20 times more courage than a Jew. The dumbest, most cowardly black is several times braver than any Jew. These are things you must take into account and you must remember. That's why you'll see the Jew is far removed from the trouble he's busy stoking. And when this trouble goes wrong, the Jew sees to it that he's not going to get hurt. He's not going to get hurt. In fact, I should interrupt this maybe with a funny story. Monica Stone used to own, this is Monica Stone of the South Africa Project.info. She used to own a garage, a petrol station. And she told me that in the 1970s, one day, a Jew pitches up at the petrol station. The blacks had been violent, they'd been chucking rocks. As you can see, this is mid-70s, now we're already in 2017, and nothing's changed, okay? So, The blacks have been doing all the nonsense that they've been taught to do, and they're still doing it. They're still setting fire to things, still chucking rocks, still burning things down and carrying on. But in the mid-70s, when this stuff was starting to really take off, this Jew pitches up at her petrol station with a little car. He had a little car, and the car was very badly dented. And the Jew was so irate, he got out and he said, you know, he'd been driving somewhere in a township or wherever, and the blacks were busy chucking rocks. And he said that he leaned out of his window and he was shouting at the blacks, but I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish. And the blacks still chucked rocks at him. So that's an example of the Jew trying to squirm out of things that are aimed at the white by saying, oh, you know, I'm Jewish. You know, I'm not really white. You know, let me off the hook. But here's the beauty where some of the Jew plan goes unstuck, okay, is that the blacks see a Jew as white. And all the non-whites of the world see Jews as white people. So that's the good news. Because I told my liberal Jewish friend and all the other dumb liberal whites of South Africa, I've said to them many times in the past, when the black guy comes to slit your throat, he's not going to say to you, oh, are you a conservative or are you a liberal? Are you a Christian or are you a Jew? He's going to come to cut your throat, okay? And that's the end of the story. But anyway, the Jews are busy working on for the enemy while they're always busy trying to squirm out of everything. That's what you'll see. They're always busy trying to squirm their way out of everything. And even when they've created enormous trouble, they make sure that their asses, their Jew asses, are fully protected. That their useless Jewish asses can jump on the next ship and plane and get out of there. So that is how the Jews organize their stuff. And these cowards are busy trying to stoke war. Now, because they are too cowardly to do it themselves, you'll only find here and there's a Jew who'll actually take part in violence. Like the Jew Ronnie Casserles. The Jew Ronnie Casserles, he led a crowd of blacks into one of the homelands, and there was a whole shoot-up, and lots of blacks got killed. So that is as close as you'll get to a Jew being violent and able to do something. In fact, Ronnie Casserles wrote a book praising his own bravery, and he called it Armed and Dangerous. Anyway, so he's the closest to a Jew with a half a ball. So the problem for the Jews is if they can't get proper men who are actually combat worthy, then they have to try and invent a war using anybody else they can find. So in America, they use fat white girls, okay? So fat white girls, dumb blacks, all these people, these are what the Jews use. This is their cannon fodder. Because the Jews need to try and pretend there's an army. And what they lack in actual fighting capacity, the Jews will make up for it by producing tons and tons and truckloads of propaganda. So the Jew media will take the events in which a lesbian fat girl does something and they'll try and turn it into a nation-shaking event. And that's what they were doing in South Africa. So they got to find people. They got to invent an army out of nothing because the black men were too useless to actually face up to the whites in real combat, and they couldn't get their act together. So eventually what they did is they brought in lots of people. What they even did was they even brought in children. Children were engaged in this. Blacks have used children in combat. In Angola, they were using 14-year-olds in combat. In South Africa, little 9 and 10-year-olds were used to actually scare their parents. So the ANC would give them guns, and they'd actually walk around, they'd threaten adults, and they'd shoot them too. They'd shoot them too, little kids. In the 80s at my work, like I mentioned to Alex, there were two blacks that I worked with who were given special mentors. Those blacks came back and they'd tell us, you know, in the township there are these little kids, they're like 10, 11, 12 years old, they got a gun, and if they tell you to do something and you don't do it, they'll shoot you. And the ANC was using kids. So these are all the kinds of dirty tricks that they were trying to do to get their dysfunctional society to be functional. So you must never imagine that the enemy is so functional. No, my man. The enemy is very dysfunctional, and eventually they managed to pull something together that they sort of call warfare, which most whites would not even recognize as a form of warfare. So the blacks don't refer to their time under apartheid as the war. But that is actually what they were trying to create. They were trying to create the war. But the war never quite got off the ground. So the war became more a series of strikes, random violence, assassinations, terrorism, some murder on the side, and that sort of thing. So it's a very messy, chaotic kind of a business. So you wouldn't know that, there's the ANC. There's the ANC army. No, there's no ANC army. There's a couple of guys running around here. Others are busy jumping on trains, throwing blacks out of windows and stuff like that. They'd be doing all kinds of stuff like that. Like if they did a lot to harm the country. The way that they won the war was by harming the country. So they tried to create as much unhappiness and unrest so that the Jew newspapers worldwide could spin this up into a huge problem for the world. And they were basically just trying to damage the economy, get businesses to shut down, get people to lose their jobs, companies to disinvest from the country and so forth. So they were trying to create warfare. And they tried to do it everywhere. They tried to do it in our workplaces. I did a lot of contracting, and at my one job, my one contract was very interesting. I worked at this rather dingy medical company. It was a medical wholesaler, and it turned into one of my most fun and exciting and fulfilling contracts that I ever had been on. It was absolutely chaotic. All the staff resigned while I was there. So there were like 15 people in the computer department. All of them were white, except for one or two, and the whole lot resigned in one go. So a handful of contractors had to take over. We had a ball. We had a fun time. And while we were there, the blacks were also busy striking. The blacks were getting violent. And so they had this warehouse where they were packing the medicines. And I remember coming to work one morning, and there on the pavement outside was a whole lot of blood. And it turned out that the blacks had been cutting up another black who had not been going along with the ANC line. And I even phoned the security police. Now, the Boers, this was almost like the Boer version of the Gestapo. So I even phoned them and I said to him, listen, there's a whole lot of communist activity going on here. And I spoke to a guy who was a major and he said, what's the name of the company? And I gave the name. And he said, yes, we know about that place. We know about it. Our problem is that the apartheid laws and the security laws don't allow us to meddle in there. We can only go in under certain conditions. And I'd say to him, but the blacks are here. They're busy doing communist shit, and they're busy trying to kill people, and they're doing all kinds of stuff that's totally disrupting the business. And he said, nope, sorry, we know about it. We're watching them, but there's nothing we can do. So that is just some of the chaos that went on in South Africa. And that's the kind of chaos that the Jews are trying to create in America. So anyway, in this environment, the blacks were continuously trying to do protests, trying to engage in violence. And there's all sorts of stories. We've not even touched on the disgusting fake news media, to use Donald Trump's terminology. Back then, the newspaper reporters would come from overseas. They'd see a black lying on a park bench or lying on the lawn, sleeping, as the blacks often do. You can go across South Africa and wherever there's a lawn, the blacks are busy having a nap. And they'll come and they'll take pictures of those blacks and they'll say, these are blacks that were shot by the Boer apartheid police, you know, shot dead. You're seeing a corpse lying there. And they did many other things. They'd come and they'd chuck a couple of coins in a rubbish bin, and the little black kids would dive in after the coins. Then they'd take snapshots and they'll say, these little black kids, they're starving, the whites are starving them, and all kinds of shit like that. They carried out so much trickery in this country. The only people who've been lied about more than the Boers are the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians, you know. So in this situation, they were constantly trying to find ways to make life unpleasant. The basic term that they were using was they wanted to make South Africa ungovernable. So they were trying to make South Africa so lawless that the Boers would eventually give up some of their political power. So that's what they were trying to do with the blacks. And they did lots of things with blacks and black crowds in the townships and strikes. Strikes was a big thing for them. But any kind of black thing that they could do. And initially in Africa, the blacks didn't want to go along with these things. So they first had to beat and kill and torture a bunch of blacks to show them that they mean business and that they will kill them and harm them if they don't take part. And so that is how they managed to eventually gain control of this country. And that is how they managed to also get these blacks to operate in big groups. And they started developing some kind of tactics for this lame army of theirs, this partly armed army. And there would be guys running around with real AK-47s and stuff, but the vast majority didn't have that. But they worked on mass action. So the ANC and their various communist organs would start gathering blacks together and forcing them to go and do stuff, to force them to go and riot somewhere. But it would actually be a controlled thing. And that is why I tell you that whenever you hear that blacks are gathering together as groups, and somebody on my channel said to me, yes, but blacks are more race conscious. Yes, my friend, of course blacks are more race conscious. Guess where they learned it from? The communists and the Jews and the liberals came and made them race conscious. Blacks weren't race conscious by themselves. The Jews and the blacks and the liberals came up with that. They were busy feeding them the whole black-white line, and they basically took the blacks of Africa and tried to make them operate as a racial group against the whites. And they said to the blacks, no, you must now forget your tribal differences. But that was very hard for the blacks to do. And even now, those tribal differences still exist. Anyhow, it was these big crowds that became a problem. And the police and the army had to deal with them. And of course, as the years went by, the ANC got bigger and bigger crowds together, and they were violent. So the Boers had to develop various tactics of dealing with them. Now, one of the things that I'm going to tell you over and over about South Africa, it's not quite as true of Rhodesia, but it's definitely true of South Africa. However, even the Rhodesians are as guilty of this as well, is that the whites never hit with the maximum force that they were capable of. The whites never hit with the full force that they were capable of. The liberals and the blacks and the commies and the Jews will tell you, oh, the apartheid government was so violent and it was so terrible. But then if you go and you find out what the professors, even the lying liberal scum professors in America are saying, they'll tell you that in 48 years of white rule, of Boer rule, that they killed only about 20,000 blacks, okay? More people than that are murdered in South Africa in any single year, okay? And just to make sure that I put it in the right context, when I say more than 20,000 people are murdered in South Africa annually, that is all races combined. That's not just whites. Whites are a portion of that. Now, the Boers were trying as much as possible to try and settle things peacefully all the time. They never went and hit with the full force that they were capable of. If the Boers used the maximum military force that they were capable of, they could have killed the blacks by the millions. Easy, easy, easy. They could have killed the blacks by the tens of millions if they were really more serious. Rhodesia as well also was doing the same thing. Always pulling their punches, holding back, not hitting the blacks with maximum force. The blacks inside Rhodesia were never hit with maximum force. Never. The only maximum force that was used was against blacks across the border. In South Africa, the blacks never knew the taste of full force of the white man. Never. They didn't even come close to tasting it. So in Southern Africa, apart from the early days of the Portuguese, which I'll return to, Apart from the early days of the Portuguese, in southern Africa, the Boers and the Rhodesians did not hit the blacks with the maximum force that they were capable of. So it was never a situation where the whites were on the edge of extermination. The whites were always holding back politically because of the Western world, especially Britain and America, Jew-ridden Britain, Jew-ridden America, continuously not supporting the whites, continuously working against the whites, and covertly wanting the blacks to win and assisting the blacks to win. So the whites here were always very careful, and the presidents and prime ministers could never really do what they wanted to do. They never could hit with all the force that they wanted to hit with. And so the number of blacks that were killed was very minor, and the whites were continuously holding back all the time. The police, the army, everybody. Minimum force, absolute minimum force all the time. That was the strategy for decades. And now they tell you, no, these people, they were cruel Nazis. They were shooting us with machine guns. Bullshit, okay? Bull fucking shit, okay? Now, I can't tell you the definitive list of tactics and strategies that the South Africans used in order to defend against these black crowds. There were things that I read, and no doubt different commanders and different generals at various times tried different things, and they may have set certain policies, but on the whole, they were trying to keep things as bloodless as possible. And they might bring in military vehicles into the townships when there was a lot of burning and stuff going on and violence going on. But on the whole, they weren't really doing a lot of violence, except when it was absolutely, absolutely necessary. So I can't speak definitively about the tactics. And maybe there are others who we can talk to later who might come forward who can tell more. I do know that they used dogs as well. They used German shepherds and various dogs. And dogs against black crowds were very effective. But the thing I'm going to tell you about is what a pal of mine told me, and his name is Gilbert. Now, Gilbert was a very interesting young Boer guy. He grew up at the end of apartheid, and he was among the last white troops who fought the blacks. And I met him in 1999, and we had quite a good friendship, and we chatted for many years. And he left South Africa, and the last I heard was that he married an American woman, and the American government would not allow Gilbert into America. That was the last I heard of Gilbert, possibly about 10 years ago, that he married a white American woman, and the US government wouldn't allow Gilbert to move into America. So I have no idea what Gilbert did, because I do know that he was out of South Africa by then. He was elsewhere. And he did some fascinating stuff. Very interesting guy. So Gilbert was this big built Afrikaans boy, Boer boy. And he was in the army in the final years before this country was handed over. So what I'm about to tell you is the type of stuff that happened in the early 1990s when de Klerk had already decided that no matter what, we're going to surrender. So de Klerk, the eternal surrendering man, he had already decided on that course. And I knew people, my mentor, Dr. Chris Jordan, who was in military intelligence, he told me how angry the army officers and the intelligence people were with de Klerk. And some of them were so angry with him, and he was absolutely rude to them when he dealt with them. They would be giving him various military reports on the violence and state of affairs in the country. And while they are busy giving their presentations, he wouldn't even be listening to them. He'd be busy talking to somebody else and ignoring them. And my friend told me of some colonel who stopped his presentation and said that he'll continue with his presentation when the president gives him his attention. So that is the kind of difficulties that these guys faced. They had this president who was already in with the Jews, the liberals, and the elite, and who didn't care who died and what was going on, because his plan was surrender. So returning to Gilbert, he was in the South African army in one of the infantry units, and he was assigned to these townships around Johannesburg. And he told me the following story. He said, this is the kind of thing that they did on a number of occasions. The ANC would gather together a crowd of people, and this is why I keep emphasizing the fact that all these mass crowds of blacks are not just blacks coming together of their own accord. This is a structure that is created. It is something that is organized and created. There are people of the ANC, military people, people in their armed wing, umkhonto wesizwe, and all these guys and their communist pals and their trade union pals, and they gather the blacks together, and they have a structure, and there are commanders and leaders. So when you see a mass of blacks coming, it's not just an amorphous mass of blacks. It is an organized army. It looks like a bunch of dancing blacks to you, but it's actually one of their lame armies that they've created. And these massive blacks come and they're dancing and singing. Now, exactly why they also do the dancing and singing, this is something that we need to dig into more. In my previous discussion with Alex Linder, I explained why I believed they came up with these things, that these were various tactics that evolved. And singing and dancing is a natural part of blacks. So if you can get blacks to sing and dance, they like that. But their dancing is not quite normal dancing. It's more a type of militant dancing, if you can call it that. Because you'll see they're doing the black power salute, and they're jumping on one leg and the other leg. And it's a little bit sort of military. It's not quite marching, but it's a militarized type of thing. So this is the blacks' way of showing their anger. And eventually they could get the blacks in masses to operate like this. And of course, they don't care whether it's black men or black women. They force them all to do the same thing. And you better do it or you're going to get a good beating. They'll beat you good and proper. So they gather these crowds together, and the crowd now comes. So now the police are there, and the police are trying to hold back the crowd. The crowd is going to be violent. There may be a few terrorists running around that crowd who maybe have got a AK-47 hidden away or whatever. But this crowd is coming at them. And so the police and the army will now try and block them and stop them and try and deal with them. So Gilbert was in a unit that was called into these kinds of situations. And what Gilbert told me was his unit would be stationed in front of the blacks. Now, what I can't remember is whether it was a battalion or whether it was a company. I think it was a company of white troops. That would mean it's about 30 guys, 32 guys, something like that. So they'd have their, I think they might have had bulletproof vests on, maybe, I'm not sure. But the white guys would be there with their military rifles, army guys lined up in front of the crowd. And now this crowd is violent, this crowd is singing and dancing, and they're doing their thing and maybe chucking rocks and threatening things. But anyway, they'd be placed in front of this crowd. And what Gilbert said to me, the way that they dealt with the crowd, was his commanding officer would then be looking in the crowd. The white military officers would look in the crowd, and they'd be looking for the people who are the leaders of the crowd. So you got this big amorphous mass of blacks, but inside that crowd are leaders. They are leaders. They don't have an army rank, but they are the leaders. Now, they are all dressed more or less the same, so now you have to try and figure out who's the leader. So the white guys would watch, the Boers would watch, and they'd try and determine who is it who seems to be energizing and stoking up the others. Who are the others responding to? And then the commander might say to Gilbert, "Gilbert, you see that guy over there with the green shirt? Okay, that guy there jumping up and down with the green shirt there. Okay, shoot him. Shoot him and do it at your own time." Then the officer will be going to another of the guys and he'll be saying to him, "So meanwhile, Gilbert's busy taking aim at that guy, trying to determine the best point, the best timing to shoot him in the head." And then the officer will be saying to the next white guy, he says, "See that guy over there on the left, the guy with the red shirt, that guy, okay, shoot him." And so they would carry on. And these white guys would be assigned different targets, and the Boer guys would then take aim, and when they feel confident that they're going to hit only that guy, then they'd fire their shot. So Gilbert might shoot the guy in the head, he drops down dead, and then the officer comes back and says, "Okay, you see that guy over there? That one over there? Shoot him." And so it carries on. So the soldiers start picking off blacks in the crowd, one by one. They start looking for who are the leaders, and they start killing them one by one. And Gilbert said that when they did this for a little while, and they'd shot a couple of these blacks, that very slowly the crowd would start to lose energy. The crowd would start to lose energy because their leaders are dead now. And the blacks would slow down and slow down, and eventually the crowd would stop, and then the blacks would just quietly walk away. And so all that the Boers have done is they've decapitated the leaders of the crowd, so they've killed a handful of people, and now the crowd goes away. It's lost its will to fight. It's lost its energy. It's lost its momentum. The leaders are dead now. And Gilbert told me that was the tactics that they used in the townships. So that is one way in which they were dealing with it towards the end. And it also shows you, again, the importance of leaders and why the Jews like to kill leaders, why the Jews aggressively destroy organizations and people that seem like they are going to grow into something. And Alex Linder was telling me that the Jewish attacks on the Daily Stormer are unbelievable. That the Daily Stormer is so successful, they are now doing anything imaginable to try and destroy the Daily Stormer. They are trying to cut their finances and their support in every conceivable way that you can imagine. So that is what Jews are doing to whites, and they have been doing it since World War II. It's a topic we're going to come back to. But here is the only known case that I know of where the Boers were applying it to the blacks. Look, they did go and try and kill individual leaders. They did try to assassinate them, like the Lithuanian Jew, Joe Slovo. He had the rank of colonel in the KGB, and he was the commander-in-chief in all of Africa for the black liberation of Africa. So the communist Jew, KGB agent, Joe Slovo, who later became the Minister of Housing, he was the commander-in-chief of all the wars in Africa. And the Boers at one point sent him a parcel bomb, and his wife opened it and it blew her away. So it didn't kill him, but it killed her. So I thought this would be an interesting lesson in some of the dynamics of how these groups work and why it is important to kill leaders and why our leaders are killed so much. And that is why guys like Matt Hale in America are in jail. Why? Because he's a potential leader. Why did David Lane die in jail? Because he's a potential leader. All the good guys, all the guys who have really got real potential, they're going to be imprisoned in America. The Jews will see to it that some trumped-up charge is arrived at so that those white men will never see the light of day again. And that is how they've managed to stop the rise of the right in America. They've done the same in Britain. They do the same everywhere. And they've even worked in South Africa to kill off any potential right wing there is. They try first to get rid of the leaders. The leaders are the first thing you got to get rid of. If you get rid of the leaders, then the people become sheeple again. And that is just the way life is. And it brings home to me again the importance of leaders and leadership. And that is why on History Reviewed, we're going to talk a lot about great men, not just some mediocre wanker. We're going to talk about great men, guys who really knew their shit, okay? Guys who were absolutely on top of their game. And the Germans, nobody was more on top of their game than the Germans under Hitler. But whites can rock, whites can totally rock, but you must understand that all of society, all of nations, all of everything is really built around leaders. And people need to start appreciating the importance and power of leaders and keeping those leaders going. Eventually, you'll realize why people choose to die for a leader rather than see the leader getting killed. Because the leader is that important. That's how important the leader is. And these things will come through on History Reviewed. But it applies to all races, all nations, all times. You need to see life as a pyramid. And a happy, healthy society, a society that is rocking and rolling, is a pyramid. And at the very top, you put the most competent, best people who have the interests of the group at heart, put them at the top, and then you have the ranks below filled in, and you have a structure whereby the babies are born, they're educated, people are guided into the places where they are going to be happiest and most effective, and so forth. You need that pyramid structure, and that pyramid structure is what whites are the best at creating. Everybody else is dysfunctional compared to the whites. Everybody else is dysfunctional. That is why everybody comes to white nations, because only whites have managed to get this working really well. So that's some food for thought for you. So that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. Have a lovely day and take care of yourselves. We'll be chatting again very soon.